And Sylvia says, no one needs to especially devise situations in which to cultivate patience. They present themselves freely. So you were saved from sitting here having me stare at you for 30 seconds. But I'm sure we can all recall times of impatience that we've experienced. And if you can recall a moment like that, just try to remember what that feels like in the body. And this is this particular talk tonight is a continuation of our series on difficult emotions. And the subtitle of that was Fight, Flight, Freeze, or Learning Opportunity. So when you call up the feeling of impatience, and as Sylvia said, it's not that hard, right? I mean, we practice that several times each day, at least I do. What's it feel like? Is that fight, flight, freeze? Which one?
Flight. For me.
Flight. Any freezers? Yeah. Any fighters willing to admit it in a Buddhist saying? They're almost all in the back, so watch out back there. So, as we know, each of us has our own background, right? That's going to cause us to react to different situations in a different way. So you can see just in that little exercise that for some people it manifests in one way and for other people it manifests in another. That's important to realize. No one's doing it wrong. They're doing it in their own way as a result of causes and conditions, right? External conditions and then whatever their own conditioning is. Personally, I've noticed in my own daily life practice that people tend to be more patient with some things and less patient with others. So, personally, I tend to be pretty patient around people. I'm extremely impatient around devices. Electronic devices. They're just supposed to work, right? And I think I got my first PC at home in 1988. They should be getting better. I mean, when I push a button, whatever I'm intending that button to do should happen immediately, correctly. And it doesn't always happen. So that's a real practice for me, is when devices don't do what they're supposed to do. I get upset. And I don't know why. I mean, they're just chunks of metal, plastic. They're just helping me do things faster than I used to do them, right? So even though I'm waiting a second and a half for that click register, it's still a lot faster than it used to be. In fact, this book is so old. I didn't check the publication date, but there's this example in here when she's giving the example of impatience, and she says like when you're driving home from work and you just can't wait to get home to see the response to that email. Can you imagine anyone in 2015, waiting to get home for anything? Yeah, we do. And we have to check them a lot, you know, because that email that you were expecting came in, but then the one you're not expecting hasn't. So you got to check it again for that one, right? So we talk about practicing internally and externally. And the internal practice is what we just did. What's that feel like inside? I mean, in the body, what does it feel like? Other than that fight, flight, freeze thing I did. What are the actual
energy,
sensations?
Like right here.
A lot of kinetic energy right here?
Right, kind of uncomfortable, prickly almost, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Great description. Yeah.
The jaw. It's really tight.
Tightness in the jaw. Uh-huh.
I feel like I'm out in front of my body.
Oh. Uh-huh.
Like I just had it this morning. I was driving and I got impatient. And it was like, I have to like come back.
Uh-huh.
To come into my
body. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and you know, out in front of your body, kind of a mental concept, but I've actually noticed a physical leaning forward often.
No, that's the flight.
Yeah.
I feel a lot of anxiety when I get impatient.
Uh-huh.
Because it's unresolved.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't like the out of control feeling.
Yeah.
When it can't be fixed real quickly.
So where's the out-of-control feeling manifest in your body?
Probably in my stomach.
Uh-huh.
And okay. My energy level really picks up and my mind starts racing.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
And I don't like that feeling.
Yeah. Doesn't really serve us either, does it? I mean, all those options that you're running through, mm-hmm. only one of them is going to happen. And you don't, as you say, you don't have any control over that. Just going to happen. Great, thank you.
And I get impatient with myself, and so I become self-critical.
Uh-huh. Oh, uh-huh.
And hold on to it, and then I walk away for a while.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I was doing that today. I was quilting, and I was not doing it right.
Uh-huh.
Threw it down and walked away.
Wonderful.
I was very impatient.
Great, but walking away is better than continuing the self-criticism.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, great, thank you. Yeah.
I find when that, I have the same thing about anything electronic, anything mechanical. I find that once it happens immediately, I lock in, it's very hard to let it go. It's mm-hmm. just, and then it continues on to the next thing, and then the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
The way I feel it is just a tightness all through my body.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel that a tightness, you know, pinching my teeth. And,
mm-hmm.
So it's. But then it's the device, like my phone, which starts doing things on its own. And I didn't do anything. And it starts tying things up. So.
Does that relax you any?
It's just kind of what the hell's going on. That could be in another realm that I don't understand.
Thank you. Yeah, there's a hand here.
I felt impatient earlier today, and I felt a cramp in the middle between my belly button and my chest, right through here.
Uh-huh.
And it just lasted for about 10 minutes or so.
Wow.
And it was just a pain, and I called the doctor. I do. I need to come in, but then it went away. But like uh-huh. at least 10 minutes, I just felt the pain right in through here.
Right. And do you recall anything right before it went away that happened or changed? Or?
Just my thoughts. My thoughts. And uh-huh. like wanting to do something, but controlling my thoughts and trying to
uh-huh.
let it go. My thinking and. Yeah. And it's still, the pain was there, but then all of a sudden it left.
Does that sometimes?
I had it like several days ago, and it was in my tummy.
Yeah.
It was just like a pain, a sharp pain, then went away, and then it came back a few minutes later, but not as much, but some pain. And then, in fact, it woke me up early in the morning. I don't know what I was dreaming.
Yeah.
And then it did it again in the tummy, and then it went away, and now this in a different place.
Yeah.
So I never had that before.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point about the connection between the thoughts or the dreams or whatever. A dream is just a form of thought, right? And then, you know, the body, that's really true. Although it's much easier to get a handle on the body than it is the thoughts, right? Certainly than the dreams, so that's why we practice with the body in this tradition. Your hand. Another hand. Yes?
I have found that impatience a lot of times evokes a lot of doubt.
Uh-huh.
Like, what am I doing?
Uh-huh.
You know, why am I spending time on this? And then my thoughts about that exacerbate my impatience and my anxiety. Like, how long am I going to spend on this? How long am I, who am I going to have to call to fix the thing or whatever, you know?
Right, right.
And is this worth my time? Then the doubt again, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So that can really trigger impatience for me.
Right.
The doubt.
Yeah, the connection with doubt.
They often really go hand in hand.
Yeah, I think it's related to this idea of all the thoughts racing through the mind, right? When there's 5,000 options, which one do I choose? Which one's going to be right?
Which one isn't going to waste my time?
Right, right. And make it worse, yeah. Good point, thank you. We could do a whole session on doubt, right? It's one of the five, one of the five main hindrances. Great, thank you. Really nice experiential reports. So, that's practicing internally. We need to learn how to do that. But impatience particularly affords us all kinds of opportunities to practice externally, which is using the suffering of others in a good way. It's actually watching others, either that we're closely involved with, which we'll probably, I would guess we would learn more from because we kind of know a little bit more about their makeup and their background and what pushes their buttons. Or just random strangers, you know, whether that's someone that's tailgating you down the road or whatever it might be in some situation where they're manifesting their impatience. And to, I mean, I think we've all had the experience where we're dealing with someone that's impatient, we get impatient too, right?
Mm-hmm.
So dealing with someone that's impatient is a kind of a unique opportunity to practice with impatience if we can recognize, just like in our own practice, our own minds, if we can recognize these unhealthy habits, these troublesome mind states, they're going to lessen a little bit. So if we can recognize in another person impatience is present, that's going to really help us de-escalate the situation. Because if we don't acknowledge what's going on in that other person, we're just going to be, what is wrong with them? You know, why don't they get... And it'll just be just this sort of more generalized, uncomfortable feeling. But if we can learn to see in another person, and the best way to do that is to learn from our own experience so we recognize it in someone else, oh, impatience is present. Let me have a little compassion for what this person's going through right now. I know what that feels like. I know what impatience feels like. Therefore, you know, let me give them what they need, a little more space or, you know, a reassuring word. Hey, you know, I'm in no hurry. You know, I'm not on my lunch hour. Don't worry about, you know, just something that allows that to open up a little bit for the other person. So learning from our own suffering, how to recognize suffering in others and then responding to that compassionately, not a bad strategy. No matter what the troubling mind state is. But in this particular case, impatience, I've found that that works for me. So, I thought of a number of areas, both in practice and in daily life, where impatience is particularly troubling. So I thought I'd just go through these. If something pops in your mind, feel free to contribute. So I thought I'd start with practice. And it seems like there are a lot of levels in practice where impatience manifests and where it becomes troublesome. So the first would be in a given single meditation session. So you sit down, you set your intention, whatever that might be for you. I'm going to sit for however many minutes, 15 minutes, 45 minutes, whatever it might be. Sit down with all the best of intentions, and at some point something else happens. Now, that might be wanting something particular to happen in that sitting. You know, maybe your intention was to just be open to whatever arises, and then the hidden agenda comes in about 10 seconds into the sitting that says, I've really got to solve that problem I've been having. I want to work on that in this sitting, you know. And then maybe impatience that the right answer isn't coming instantly. You know, does any of this sound familiar?
Yes.
So, you know, within a given sitting, they tend to be kind of at that level, almost at the level of a single thought. The, you know, this idea that I've got, or this to-do list that I need to make, or this that I have found, I'm just speaking for myself here, that the impatience within a single sitting is often at the level of a single thought or task. Recognizing, partway into it, I just remembered I have to do X, Y, Z, And then forgetting that every other time that's happened and the thing was important enough, you've remembered it when the sitting is over, right? But in that moment, it's like, got to jump up and write it down or whatever. And then just the, being able to just, okay, come back to the breath, come back to the body, whatever it might be. This practice with recognizing where impatience manifests in the body, maybe being able to name it in this case, rather than labeling it as, here's that to-do list again, just saying, impatience. Impatience is present. That's what it feels like in the body. It's a wavering in the chest, or it's a racing of thoughts, a particular kind of racing of thoughts. So try that. Then there is being on retreat. So a number of us just got back from Sim's first 10-day retreat, Sim's 11th residential retreat. The first one was in 2004, and we missed 1 year. Here, the first Sim pilgrimage, 2007. And so, first 10-day. There may be some on this retreat that got to 7 days and thought, nothing's happened yet. The theme of the retreat this year was awakening. I haven't been awakened yet. That stuff they keep talking about every night hasn't happened for me yet. Might be day 8, day 9, I've been on week-long retreats before and I'm no more calm and centered than I was on a week-long, and it's been 8 days. What's up with that, There are these little hidden agendas that on a retreat have a little bit more time to manifest than in a single sitting. So these tend to be in the realm of wanting the arc of the retreat to go in a certain way. And again, I'm just talking for myself here. This is no, ancient wisdom from the Buddha or anything like that. We never seem to have that problem. in fact, you read the literature, and I couldn't even find any stories about the Buddha being impatient. Even before he was awakened. I had to, they had some Jataka tales about when he was a buffalo or whatever, to try to find anything about impatience. And it wasn't him, it was the monkey in the tree that was impatient. So, really the arc of a retreat, I think all of us, even though everybody said, don't have any expectations around this retreat, just let whatever happens, happens. I spent all this time, and I put everything on hold, and got 260 emails when I get home. We've got to get something out of this. I got to get something out of this, I can't just sit here and watch my mind for a week. That wouldn't be worth it. So worth it, all these ideas are all about expectation, right? And the first thing they say when you go on a retreat, don't have any expectation. Don't come into it with an agenda. Don't expect to work on that big problem that's been bothering you for the last 48 years, and resolve it in this week long or even 10 days. It's not going to happen. So that setting up of expectations, it's a different kind of feeling than disappointment. Just setting up an expectation and not quite meeting it. That's where you get into the self-critical stuff. Maybe I'm not good enough. Seldom do we say, maybe I set the bar too high. Isn't that funny? We never say I set the bar too high. We say I didn't jump high enough. Why don't we just say I set the bar too high and bring it down? We can jump over it. Have a little success. But we don't do that on retreat. We say, I was, 10-day retreat. I should really advance my practice. I should deepen my practice in this time period. Well, maybe that's not going to happen. Maybe just whatever's going to happen is what's going to happen, huh? You ever thought about that possibility? I mean, it's a very real possibility that maybe whatever's going to happen happens. Okay. Some people call that karma, but we'll just leave it at whatever was going to happen happens. So watch for that when you do go on retreat. I mean, all best of intentions, the things are going to arise, but maybe recognize that as impatience. Not, oh, I set the bar too high, or these teachers are lousy, or boy, if the food was only better, I'd have it all figured out by now. But just recognizing in the course of a retreat that, you know, maybe that thing that's keeping you from just being able to settle into the retreat is a bit of impatience happening, and recognizing that. Any of the yogis from the recent retreat want to add to that? Any flavors?
Yes to all of that.
Yeah. It's because I experienced it all. I'm just speaking from experience here. So.
But another flavor of retreat-based impatience that I experience often is, when's it going to be over?
Yeah.
And still that kind of leaning ahead.
Right. Yeah, that's right. And that, Laura's been on 6-week retreats, so she knows a bit about longer ones, but I mean, that doesn't just happen on 6-week retreats, right? That happens on day longs. So yeah, just to watch for that. Just like in a sitting, you know, oh, when's that darn bell going to ring? That's 40 minutes. So you can imagine the same thing arising in a week long or a 10-day or a 6-week retreat. When's it going to be over?
Well, one of the things that I did notice was there were times that I was really, really, really wanting the bell to ring.
Mm-hmm.
And then other times that I was surprised when it did.
Yeah.
It's like strange how, and it, a lot of times it was around circumstances like whether or not I was feeling physically tight or mentally tight.
Yeah.
So that then I was like, please, bell, please, I want the bell to ring, please, you know.
Yeah. So isn't this amazing? The mind, and this isn't personal, as you know, Linnell, but isn't it amazing what the mind does? So we go to all of this trouble to arrange for a week or 10 days of meditation. We, you know, people around us are holding things together for us, co-workers are dealing with difficult situations, we've finally cleared the calendar to get away, and we get on retreat, and we have a little 40-minute sitting, and we say, when's the bell going to ring?
Right.
You know?
Well, and
it's amazing. The human mind is just...
But the piece about impatience, amazing, too, is to think that having the bell ring is actually going to make a difference.
That's right. Yeah, well... That's the other thing that's amazing. It actually does make a difference.
Well,
I mean,
somewhat, but you know, your mind sort of stays with you whether the bell.
Well, yeah, of course. But I mean, I've had sittings when I'm like in physical pain.
Yeah.
I label it as physical pain,
right,
even though it's probably just
right,
a mild discomfort. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like, when that bell's going to ring, and you're getting tighter and tighter. And then the bell rings, and you're just like, ah. You haven't moved, you know, your mind is finally relaxed, but you haven't moved, your body's in the same position it's been in for the last 40 minutes or the hour or whatever it's been. Your mind's an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing. The other one is the entire arc of our practice. So, you know, I mean, an individual sitting, you're kind of dealing at the level of a thought, you know. At the level of a retreat, you know, you can afford yourself the luxury of getting impatient about bigger and better things. So you can worry about your relationship, your job, you know, that some larger things that involve like little complex networks of thought. What about the arc of our practice? Do any of us ever get impatient there? You know? I mean, we got an email in the beginning class just started last week. So we got an email from someone that's had 1 week of meditation, and the person said, I sat for 20 minutes and didn't notice any change at the end. You know, and we laugh, but I mean, that's sort of a microcosm of all of our view of our own practice. You know, either why aren't we changing more? Why is everything else changing except this one thing that I started my practice to get rid of? I still haven't gotten rid of it. Wonder why? You know, all this sort of thing. And this is where doubt really comes in. Because we practice for a while, you know, you've all heard the quote from the Dalai Lama, right? They said, oh, well, has your practice made a difference in your life? Well, after 5 years, no, nothing. You know, after 10 years, maybe a little bit, you know. After 40 years, yes, I can say there's been some change. We need that attitude. This is a guy that, you know, was raised, in his view, since before he was born, to practice. To practice and teach and study what we do here. And he's saying, 5, 10 years, not much change, but I'll just keep at it. So, what are we doing saying, oh, well, you know, I've been practicing for a while, how come, you know, it's a mini version of how come I'm not enlightened yet, right? Why haven't I gotten rid of that impatience that I've had? Why haven't I gotten rid of my anger issues? Why, you know, all that. So, I mean, you know, in addition to the wisdom, we need compassion, and this is one particular place where we need compassion. I remember talking to Dennis. I was impatient before my practice even started. I was talking to Dennis right when I first started my practice, getting classes going on. I said, Dennis, I started in my 50s. I said, Dennis, by the time I've been practicing as long as you and John, I'll be dead. Why didn't I find this practice before? You know, I grew up in Marin County for God's sake, you know. Probably every form of meditation ever invented was being practiced, you know, in every corner around my house. Spirit Rock was 10 miles away. Not when I was growing up, but eventually. And he said, you know, it's about ripeness. When these things, it's what we were saying earlier, when it's going to happen, it'll happen. I just wasn't ripe. Whatever conditions were present in my life at that time were not ripe for this particular practice. I was a spiritual seeker my whole life, but not this particular form of practice. So we need to have some patience and some kindness with ourselves about the overall arc of our practice. We also need to recognize that freedom, awakening, enlightenment, whatever you want to call it, is one of those paradoxical things that the more we want it, the more we're getting in the way of allowing it to happen. It's not something that we can force. Sayadaw Utejaniya says, you know, there's three things that you can't do better by trying hard. You know, one is going to the toilet, one is falling asleep, and the other one is meditation or awareness. Can't do any of those by trying harder. So, you know, pushing yourself to get enlightened is trying harder. It's trying too hard. Okay? So, which brings us to the difference between a goal and an aspiration. So it's just semantics, but I'm just going to use these two words to illustrate something here. So a goal to me is I'm going to lose 5 pounds by, you know, Thanksgiving so that I can put it all on again. I'm going to get my, you know, marathon mile time down to 7 minutes. I'm going to, you know, those are goals. Aspirations are something that's a little farther out, so you can't really see the details of it, but you're moving towards it. I think you've all heard the illustration that Dennis uses, and I just love it, of when one of these probes, I forget if it was a Mercury probe or something going toward the moon or whatever, some space vehicle, was going to whatever its object was, say it's a moon. 90% of the time it's off course, and it still got there. You know, it's off course this way, it's off course this way, three-dimensional, right? So it's off course that way, it's off course this way. But course corrections the whole time. Course corrections, and it got where it was going. 90% of the time it was off course. You know, I think generously, some of us may even do better than that in our practice, you know? It might be 89 or 88% of the time we're off course, but we're still heading in the direction toward Mars or moon or whatever, toward that thing out there. Now, the fact that we haven't gotten there yet, it's okay. You know, we're watching our practice, we're aware of it, we're making those little course corrections, and, you know, the big picture, we're still on course. You know, in the moment, we might be off course, but you know, if we can sort of stay on course long enough to keep moving toward, I like that language. Keep moving toward something. Doesn't mean we have to be aimed straight at it or using the exact perfect practice that we'll be using 2 seconds before we get there or heading in that direction. It just means we keep moving toward. So, you know, some kindness around the overall arc of your practice. And that includes everyone from those of you that have been practicing for decades to those of you that are here for the first time. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Also, a couple of particularly rich areas in daily life, I know for me. Speech. So, this is going to really date me, but do you guys remember the Bob and Ray routine, the Slow Talkers of America?
No.
Oh my God, it is so hilarious. I can't even read that on the page without just dying. I was going to bring it in, but I thought, nah. I won't do it justice, but it's these two guys talking. One of them is a member of the Slow Talkers of America. So the other guy, you know, starts filling in his words for him and stuff, and just the timing of it's really hilarious. But all of us do that to some level, right? I mean, person's talking to us, even if they talk fast, we're a step ahead of them. Human mind is really fast, right? So we're a step ahead of them. We're thinking ahead. Where are they going with this? When is it going to be my turn to pitch in my thought? Ooh, what they just said? That reminds me, you know, I got to get that milk on the way home from dinner tonight. What were you saying? Oh, yeah. Mind's constantly moving like that. That's a form of impatience. The inability to just be with that person and really being open to what they're saying, both on the verbal and nonverbal level, is a not-so-subtle form of impatience. And speech is one of the areas where it really, really manifests. It's a great time to practice. So watch for the particular patterns that you might have that cause you to be unable to hear what somebody else is saying. And watch the mind's tendency to be formulating a response before the thing you're responding to has even finished being said. And there's a whole constellation and tons of material out there to help you with it on how to be a little bit more patient around speech. It's a really rich area. Any personal experiences here of a particular troubling manifestations of impatience in speech situations?
Speech is the hardest of all the precepts.
Absolutely. It's very, very hard.
It is. It's very hard.
I mean, it's if you're as impatient as me, and it's hard not to fill in words for people.
Right.
You know, while you're listening to them. If you really, even setting an intention to just sit and listen, and everybody takes a minute or has a delay to think about what they're going to say next, you know.
Right.
It's hard not to fill in what I think they're going to say or should say, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So absolutely, it's a huge form of impatience.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about, so I teach a study skills class to sixth graders, and when I lecture, sometimes I get going really fast. I'm trying to get through things, and then they're sixth graders, so they like to talk. So then I'm like, you have to stop talking, and I'm rushing through things. And it's a study skills class, so I'm, you know, one of the things I'm trying to teach is patience. And then there I go, trying to rush things through, and I you know, I have to catch myself, and sometimes it's like, if I can't get through, that's just how it is.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do that regularly in class.
Yeah, good observation. Yes?
It's also really conditional for me. I mean, there's certain people who I'm pretty impatient with and just can cut them off or fall back in other patterns, and other people, especially who are good listeners, tend to make me want to be a good listener too. And I'm somehow more with them then I would be the other one.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One that I see myself doing, I hear other people talk about it, is you're formulating what you're going to say. You're formulating mm-hmm. your answer or response or comment to what they're saying, and that's going on in your mind, and found that I'll tend to miss a lot more of what they're saying. I've already tuned in that out because I'm already tuned into this this brilliant response. I'm going to just terminate the argument or just bowl over the bowl them over with my intellectual prowess.
Thank you. Yes.
I have found that when you're listening and speaking from the heart, that the conversation becomes a bit more genuine, and then that, like you were just saying, Ryan, the reciprocation of that conversation tends to go where you want it to go if you have the conversation partner that is picking up on that. But oftentimes in meetings, that's not going to happen because you don't have some mindfulness with the other group members, and then that's where the impatience comes in.
Right. Yeah. So, I'm assuming when you say where you want it to go, you're not talking about the end result, but rather you want it to go deep.
I think the ongoing dialogue of everybody being a thoughtful listener, so the dialogue does continue from that point of view, I guess.
Right. Yeah. And, think about it. To even speak from the heart takes patience, because that's not our first impulse, right? Our first impulse is just to rattle off whatever thoughts are bouncing around in our head. So to even take that pause and look, well, wait, what is my real intention here? What is it that I really want to say, and how can I say it so that it'll be heard? It takes a little bit of kind of checking in and a little bit of patience right there.
I kind of had both experiences in one meeting today. I cut into somebody who was talking. I thought they were done, and I started, and they hadn't finished, so I had to, like, oops, sorry, let them finish. But I also noticed that maybe it was just because I'd been on retreat, and so I'm still a little slowed down to what I think is a more reasonable pace, actually. But the conversation was just going so fast, and I wanted mm-hmm. to take a minute and actually absorb what people were saying and kind of digest it a little bit, but I was just not keeping up with, there's people were jumping in so fast and putting in their piece, putting in this piece, and there was just so much going on that I was just having a hard time. And I wasn't particularly distracted. It wasn't just mm-hmm. like that. It was just that I was listening at a pace that wasn't keeping up with what the conversation was happening.
Right, good point.
Yeah. So I guess that's externally, because I was going to say how impatient other people were to just not leave any space for people to just sit with what had been said, really.
That's right. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. How about driving?
I'm very patient driving.
Goes without saying, huh? You are.
Yeah,
please.
I am very patient driving.
That's your secret.
I'm old now. I don't care. So I don't get upset anymore at driving. If somebody drives too slow or too fast, that's their problem. I just don't get upset at it anymore. That's one less thing I don't get upset about.
Well, congratulations. You're an inspiration to all of us.
I never say bad words to them or anything. They do say it to me occasionally, but...
Great. Thank you. There's hope. There's hope.
I have a really wonderful driving story, personal driving story.
Please.
I was a terribly angry driver at one point in my life, and I lived in L.A. where there are lots of other really angry drivers. And on my way home from work one time, I think the guy behind me wanted to go around me or something, and the cars weren't spaced right, and he was being real aggressive, and I flipped him off. And we got to a stop sign, and he got out of his car, and he came around and stood next to my side, and my window was rolled up, and he shook his fist in my face, and he was a whole lot bigger than I was. And after that, I thought, okay, maybe I won't be quite so impatient anymore. Let's be a little more polite. The guy could have had a gun. He could have, you know, who knows? And I thought, my impatience going to temper is not useful. And it really taught me a lesson.
And stuck.
Yeah.
It stuck for you, yeah.
Definitely stuck.
Wow.
It just ratcheted, you know, it just ratcheted it down.
Yeah. Glad you were safe.
Yeah, actually, I have two. One habit that I ended up getting into, because I was in the Bay Area, which, again, like LA, but, so I got, you know, stuck in traffic forever, and then if somebody tried to cut me off, what I'd automatically do is go, okay, when was the last time I cut somebody off?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then what was going, well, I was late, I had to go pick up mm-hmm. my daughter, so it got perspective. So, but what I've done recently, the beginner meditation class has given us an assignment to, throughout the day, you know, start to create a habit of just being able to stop and pay attention to your breath for 3 minutes. Mm-hmm. So do something that you do regularly. Somebody, you know, like if you're brushing your teeth, well, that's an indicator, well, now I've got to pay attention to my breath. So whatever, you go to the bathroom, then take that time to, so every time I'm at a stop sign or a stoplight, I take the opportunity to check in with my breath. So that's helping me
cool.
tremendously. Yeah, so.
Fantastic.
Instead of going, gosh, I need to go do
it.
Oh, breath.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
I think what stopped me from getting impatient driving is I didn't understand suffering. When I began practicing, I just didn't understand all this suffering stuff. So I was on the train one day, and the train stops at Emeryville, and you change to a bus, got in the bus, and there was somebody there that apparently was late for a meeting and was carrying on like you wouldn't believe, and I looked at him and I thought, oh my God, he's suffering. That's what that is, right? And I realized he had no control over what was happening, and he's just sitting there having a hissy fit about having a hissy fit, I guess, and I realized that you don't need that suffering, and I did that too, you know,
mm-hmm.
I just didn't recognize it,
right.
And when you don't have control, there's no point in it.
Yeah, thank you.
Unless it makes you feel better, I don't know.
Well, sometimes even if you think it does in the moment, at long range it doesn't.
No.
We usually regret those things we say in those moments, right?
And it's, you
come
have
back
no
to
control.
Us later. Yeah. Thank you.
So that's how I feel about driving.
You're a Yoda of the driving world.
Yeah, I'm the Yoda of the driving world.
The other place, and this is common from Buddhist stories, is the public marketplace, right? So the Buddha figured out he wasn't enlightened when he was doing all those concentration practices, and then he'd get in these exalted states and feel really great, and he'd go into the marketplace and get all this dirt stuff was happening, right? So our own public marketplaces, and I'm telling this story with permission to life partner, wife Mary is here. She told me this story. So we're at the farmer's market. I was off getting something else. She's in the line in this really great vegetable stand that has all kinds of stuff. Some of them are by the pound and some of them are by the each, right? So bell peppers, 2 for $1. So she had 2 bell peppers in a bag and she had $1. And she got in line. This big, long line, kind of. Depending on how many things have to be weighed out by the people in front of you, that line can move slowly or it can move faster. And so the thought popped into her mind, well, I have $1, I have 2 for $1, I just go up there and just drop $1 on the counter. And she thought, no, I'm not going to do that, I'll just wait in line. So she's waiting in line, and this other woman comes up, from the side of the line, goes right to the front of the line, 2 peppers in her bag, puts down her $1, and the woman that was, you know, farmer's market is dealing with this other person weighing all this stuff, and she just stopped and she looked at the woman and she said, next time, would you please wait your turn like everyone else? You know?
That's nice.
It's
what timing.
Yeah. You know, and it's recognizing none of us are special. You know, I mean, there's that. I always project on people that do crazy driving, oh, they think they're special, or the rules don't apply to them, or whatever, you know? That's just my own particular delusion, but that's my particular thing. And you know, but you see something like that, and it's like, well, how come the rules that apply to all the rest of us don't apply to this person? So I think that was just a great illustration of, first of all, the value of restraint, right? Because we all have these impulses, you know, the impatience, whatever it might be. Oh, I'd like to take the shortcut on this one. And then, you know, life just sometimes has a way of jumping up and saying, maybe you don't. Maybe you don't want to do that. And then, you know, the classic is standing in line at the grocery store, right? And, you know, the classic story of that is when Jack Kornfield tells. I don't know how many of you have heard this, but I don't know if I can get through it without breaking down. But so this guy gets back from, forget if it was the first Iraq War. Let's just say it was the first Iraq War. Gets back, standing in the line at the grocery, and while he's waiting in line, you know, he wants to get stuff. He doesn't know a lot of stuff. He wants to get through this line. And while he's standing there in line, this person comes up with a baby. And he's talking to the checker. So the checker's trying to check and dealing with the baby and all that kind of stuff. And he's like, oh my God, you know, I'm just about to say something and, you know, baby left. So the person in front of him says, oh, you know, I noticed that baby. You know, what's the deal here? She goes, oh, that's my baby. My mom brings it over. My husband's deployed right now overseas. And that's the only chance I have to see her. And that cured him permanently of impatience, mm-hmm. He reports. Because he reported it a day long or something to Jack. That had cured him permanently of impatience. Because he restrained from saying anything. He was going to say, kind of like the other situation we talked about. He's going to say something. It's like, come on, let's move on with it. Who is this person that's interrupting, you know, the flow of business here? But he didn't. And then realized, oh my gosh, the harm I could have done, first of all. You know, and that didn't happen. And then, you know, the healing in his own heart that happened as a result mm-hmm. of that. So, the public marketplace. So let's just take a brief look at patience. Again, it is one of the perfections of the heart. And I remember John Travis years ago saying, true patience is not a cat waiting in a mouse hole. You know, you're not waiting to pounce. You are just there for whatever arises in this practice. This particular quality that we're talking about, right? I mean, you may be, that may be something else, but it's not true patience. Sylvia's definition is, patience develops the habit of abiding. That word sound familiar? Satipatthana Sutta. The yogi abides, clinging to nothing in this world, right? They both yogi abides, contemplating internally, contemplating externally. You know, that word abides. So patience develops the habit of abiding by understanding this will change and I'm not in charge. This will change, insight into impermanence, and I'm not in charge. Insight into the characteristic of not self, right? I'm not in charge. Causes and conditions are happening, and I'm not in charge. Right there, you've got, you know, and then obviously that leads to an understanding of suffering. So you got the three insights that we're working toward in this practice. So patience develops the habit of abiding by understanding this will change, and I'm not in charge.
Can I say?
Please.
When we went on the pilgrimage last year, we had twice that the bus broke down, and we ended up standing by the side of the highway, at one time a pretty busy highway, and then for like an hour and a half, and then the other time in a little neighborhood village that hardly any tourists ever stop at, I'm sure. And both times ended up being actually really kind of cool experiences, mm-hmm. like local people rode over to say hi to us from the side of the road, and we watched a beautiful sunset, and another time we got to have chai in this little stall, you know, where, like I said, no tourist probably has ever had chai. And but it was a definite opportunity for us to practice that abiding, you know, just because we were totally, you know, dependent on
other people to come and bring the cart and climb into the bus and do the thing that had to be done. So anyway, I just thought of that when you were talking about that, because it was such an opportunity to be impatient, but also an opportunity just to practice, because there was really nothing else we could do.
Great. Thank you. So they all up for a little bedtime story? This is one of my favorite stories. So some of you may be familiar with the simile of the saw, you know, that you should not think a harmful thought about anyone, even if, you know, bandits caught you and were cutting your limbs off one at a time, you know that one? Terrible. But the build-up to that is this story. Simile of the saw gets told more often than this story for some reason. I don't know why. I think this story is more relevant to our everyday lives. So he starts off, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'll just start it off and give you the outline. Once monks in this same Savatthi, he was giving this talk in Savatthi, which is Shravasti, present-day Shravasti. There was a lady of a household named Vedahika. This good report about Lady Vedahika had circulated. Lady Vedahika is gentle. Lady Vedahika is even tempered. Lady Vedahika is calm. Now, Lady Vedahika had a servant named Kali, who was diligent, deft, and neat in her work. So Kali thinks to herself, I wonder if she's really patient, or if she's just that way because I do such a great job maintaining the household. So I'm going to wake up late tomorrow, see what happens. So she wakes up late, and Vedahika asks her, why did you get up after daybreak? No reason, madam. She says, no reason. Angered and displeased, she scowled. So Vedahika scowls at her. So, as in most fairy tales, happens again. This time, angered and displeased, Vedahika grumbled. The third time, and so Kali says, boy, this is working, so I'm going to keep doing this. So she does it a third time. Got up even later in the day. Then Lady Vedahika said to her, hey, Kali. Yes, madam. Why did you get up even later in the day? No reason, madam. No reason, you wicked servant, and yet you get up even later in the day? Angered and displeased, she grabbed hold of a rolling pin and gave her a whack over the head, cutting it open. And then Kali went through the town saying, ah, now we know how patient and kind Vedahika is, with blood coming out of her scalp, right? So this is really interesting. And what caught me in this story, reading it, again, I read this story many times and I never noticed the progression of actions from Lady Vedahika. So the first one is nonverbal. She scowls. The second one is verbal, right? So it's inside of our head. We can't restrain ourselves anymore. We speak. She grumbled. If we don't get control of us, if we let that cycle of reactivity continue to run, it turns into unskillful action, right? That's how we teach that cycle of reactivity. So she grabbed hold of a rolling pin and gave her a crack over the head. So it goes from nonverbal to verbal to unskillful action. That sound familiar to anybody? So the story, you know, in addition to talking about causes, you know, conditionality, that, oh yeah, it's very easy to be even tempered when everything's going our way. But all of a sudden, when it doesn't go our way, the bus breaks down, or, you know, the clerk in front of us in line is talking to a woman and a baby instead of dealing with business. It's very easy to let things go off the rails. But, you know, the lesson here is we're not here to change the outside circumstance. We're here to change the inside so that no matter what the outside circumstance is, we're going to be okay with it. We're going to find a way to be okay with it. What this practice is about. So, just in closing, I would, then we have time for a couple more comments. I would just recommend learning what it is that triggers your impatience. You know, as was alluded here earlier, you know, each of us has different triggers for impatience. Each of us has different people that push our buttons. And if you can learn what those are, you can actually be more skillful when they arise, because you'll be aware that that's a condition that sets you off. So I'd recommend that to you. Find out what it is that causes impatience and start to do a little bit of investigation around what it takes to work with that in the moment. Final thoughts? Yes.
Rich, what's the relationship between impatience and restlessness, at least in the Buddhist hindrance of restlessness?
Impatience is considered an unskillful mind state. Restlessness, in the way we use the language, is generally considered an agitation that manifests in the body. And it's obviously a manifestation of a troubled mind, but it can come from many different sources, not just impatience, but it can come from an excess of energy. Even a neutral excess of energy will manifest in the body as restlessness if you try to settle down. So restlessness is a more, is a broader condition, primarily a bodily condition, that can result from many different causes, whereas impatience is a specific mind state that manifests when we're not getting what we want, typically, you know. And to me, impatience has a specific time reference. We're not getting what we want in time, you know. It's not happening as quickly as we want, or, you know, that sort of thing. I would call impatience if it's just, you know, we're angry at another driver just because they did something we don't like, then that may be something else. That may be, you know, irritation or anger or aversion or something like that. But to me, impatience has a specific time vector. Things aren't happening as quickly as we'd like them to. Either, you know, as I said, either in our meditation in this particular sitting period or on a retreat or in the arc of our entire practice and then in these different areas of daily life. All right, well, let's just take a moment to just recognize how fortunate we are to be here. There are so many that don't have homes, either in the physical sense or the metaphysical sense. Whether that's people that have been driven out of their country by war, or people that have lost their homes to fire, those who have this practice always have a refuge, whether they have a physical home or not. So just reflecting on how fortunate we are to have found this practice and the community of others who are practicing with us, and just by that fact supporting us in our practice. And from the deepest part of our being, wishing that any benefit that we may realize from practicing together, no matter how small, ripples out and is a support for all those who suffer, whether that's from mental or physical, psychological pain, extending whatever good arises from our practice for the intention of lessening harm and reducing suffering for all beings. May all beings be safe. May all beings be happy. May they be as healthy and strong as their current circumstances allow. May all beings be free from suffering.